where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
You know, Reverend, I want to thank Curtis Lewa for allotting some of his time so Governor Patterson could come on the air today, you know, and speak with us. I know that, you know, it's quite a sacrifice, but he does that for his good friend, and he calls him his husband-in-law, right? Am I right on that?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
We will avoid the domestic conversation.
Yeah. Okay. So years ago, I remember they asked a chaplain in Congress, it must be so inspiring. You walk in, you look out the window, you see the country, and then you offer a prayer for Congress. He said, that's not exactly how it works. First, I look at Congress. Then I offer a prayer
for the country.
So I'm just wondering, does that apply now to the city council? That, you know, first I see the city council, then I pray for the city of New York. How do you understand this how many stops legislation that overrode the mayor's veto? Is it something you see as a serious impediment? Do you see it as, you know, unnecessary? How do you see it, Governor?
Well, I think that the bill involving the documentation of almost everything the police officer does from the time they come to work to the time they go home, which is effectively reducing the number of police officers that are available. Because when someone's writing about what they were doing, they're not really available. And, it's a pretty dangerous situation. And I think that the city council and the mayor got hung up on the meaning of the term, when you incarcerate someone by themselves.
Solitary
confinement. Mm-hmm. The mayor was quoting what was really the international principle of it, which was a confinement where people, you know, would spend months by themselves in different places, and had to do with war crimes and that kind of thing. What the city council, I think, so in that respect, I think the mayor missed what they were trying to say. And the city council, I think, missed the fact that there really isn't confinement more than 4 hours at any point in the city. So I think both sides really in the discussion would not accept some of the facts about the situation. And so, I kind of think that they will continue to sort of work that out together, even though the city council overrode the veto.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of them kind of know that there are just certain cases, you know, certain times there are inmates who it's like you can't leave them alone. I mean, you can't put them in the general population for more than 2 hours without there being some kind of a problem.
You know,
so that's what I thought about that.
Before you get to the other, Reverend and I had on a guest some time ago who was the commissioner of Department of Corrections and Community Services. We spoke about solitary, and he said people have a real misconception of what solitary is. As you clarified, Governor, you're not put into a dungeon and left there for 24 hours. You have access to communications. You get a tablet, and you are away from the general population. That's what the solitary is, because you're a danger to the general population.
I think it depends on what prison you're talking about, because I've spoken to inmates in maximum security prisons, and in those cells of solitary confinement, the only air they get is from the place where they slide the food in and out. And it's quite an experience for them.
But aren't they allowed to go outside for a short period of time?
Very, very short. Depends on...
like an hour or two a day.
Yeah.
But why are they in solitary? Why are they placed in solitary? Because they're dangerous.
Supposedly they're a danger, but we don't know how the prison system is run in that particular prison. We don't know what the context is, what's at play, because there are a lot of things that go on within the system that are illegal, that are not wrong. And unfortunately, these inmates become victims of it. And someone has to say something. So it depends, Rabbi.
Well, not my understanding of it. But I want to go into the how many stops, because that's the the legislation has troubled many, many people. You know, you have communities crying out for more police protection. Even though the numbers are more favorable, crime is on the way down, people don't feel safe. So, as you said, Governor, when you have people doing administrative work instead of the policing they need to do, that diminishes the time necessary to for dedication to, you know, protecting people. Right?
Yes, exactly. I think that what really tipped the scales with this piece of legislation was the research that showed that 97% of the people who were stopped were either black or Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's such an incredible number, and it really kind of shocked me because I really believe, as a person who I have shared from time to time, got stopped by a policeman 6 weeks after I came out from being governor, because I ran up the stairs from the subway, and I guess he thought I had stolen something.
Mm-hmm.
And when the police was talking to me, this other citizen came over and said, you know, I don't think you should speak that way to anybody, officer, least of all the former governor of the state of New York. And so I walked away, and the two of them were talking, and then the policeman calls me, asked me to come back. He said, were you really the governor? I said, yes. He said, would you take a picture with me? I'm like, this guy. But really, in a serious sense, there was, when I was growing up, kind of a almost a mystique. I mean, it was fear that if the police ever stopped you, you were, like, in big trouble. Like, for whatever, even if you weren't doing anything wrong. Now, that's a misperception. But it's a misperception based on a lot of experiences that were shared about things that really did happen in those days. I really feel that those days are gone. And in other words, I don't know exactly what's causing still this, you know, this impropriety, but it seems that maybe there's a there's a perception that sometimes the officers get that is not necessarily racist. It's just that they haven't gotten over this, you know, sort of fear that that most African Americans they see walking on in the streets are doing something wrong.
Well,
I think that antagonized the city council members and why they were really kind of unrelenting in this particular situation, because really, right now, with the number of people retiring from the force and recruitment not going that well, we need officers being police members and not keeping diaries.
Right, right. The administrative work, the paperwork. I mean, how many times have we seen from years ago officers complaining about the amount of paperwork that's involved in any given situation?
Let me ask both of you. But haven't you seen greater strides being made in terms of community relations, that there's been a concerted effort to understand each other more, to get to know the community better? Hasn't that been a priority of the new policing that has taken place over the years?
That's what I was saying, Rabbi. I saw an incident about 2 years ago. It was during the summer, and this man had set up a stand as a vendor, and he was cooking food and selling it to people. And I was standing there. Now, the police officers came up. They didn't – I did not get that they recognized me at all. And they said to him, listen, sir, we appreciate what you're trying to do, but you don't have a permit to do that, but we can show you how to get one. They had this conversation. Mm. A vendor actually offered them some food after it was over, and I thought to myself, wow, things have really changed. You know, he had no fear of them. They both spoke cordially to each other. And I was thinking about how great it was, and I came home that night, and I think that night there was an assault on a number of police officers in Dallas, Texas, a few of them killed, and it just made me know that maybe it's changed here, but it hasn't changed everywhere.
You know, yeah, and in these anecdotes question whether things have changed or point to the fact that maybe things have changed. It's a tough thing. But, you know, the legacy of looking at persons of color, especially men of color, African-American men of color, as deviant, you know, so we're suspect immediately. I think that it's still residual to the history here in America. And it's difficult to change cultures. It's difficult to change systems. I believe things have changed dramatically, but there's still a long way to go.
So the answer is not, though, to increase administrative workload. It's in terms of trying to better the relationship with the different communities.
Well, when I get statistics tossed at me, I'm wondering, okay, you know, what's the source of those stats? What was the sampling? I mean, I ask questions to understand. Why is it that 97%, I think was said, of the stops were persons of color? All right. And is there a concentrated effort in certain communities that will naturally raise the number of stops and the number of inquiries if most of them are taking place in certain communities, communities of color, right? If we're taking the same number of stops in another community, that's a white community, all right? If we're doing the same thing, we'll probably get different statistics on it.
When I was in the state Senate, the 28th Police Precinct, which is in Harlem, the 125th Street area, and every time they changed a group of officers that were there, they started this situation where they had the officers come and visit the elected officials. So I was sitting with these officers, you know, just telling them what I thought they could do sometimes to make things a little easier and what some of the fears of the people in the community are about the police. And then I said to them, listen, I represent Harlem, but I didn't grow up in Harlem. I grew up in Long Island. And when I moved into this neighborhood, I had some of the fears that I'm sure many of you had, because this is, you know, kind of how the neighborhood was perceived. And I kind of had to get over them. But I remember whenever it was dark, I would run from the subway home thinking that, you know, I was likely to get mugged. But the reality was that I had bought in the same anxiety probably that a lot of those officers had. And it turned out to be one of the most interesting meetings that I was ever in my life, because once I opened that door, a lot of the officers started admitting to feelings that they had and how they would really work hard to try to get over them. And I don't know if they're still continuing the practice with the NYPD, but I thought it was a great opportunity for some of the elected officials to share in a meeting, not in a confrontational place, with the officers what the situation was, because those were some very successful encounters.
So Governor, the mayor's response was, okay, come out on the street with us. Let's ride. Let's do a ride in the car so you could see exactly what the officers go through and the negative impact that something like this would have if they had to spend more time, especially dealing with low-level offenses. Do you think that that was successful?
Well, apparently not. I don't know if any of the council members went. Maybe a couple of them did.
A few did.
But I was, I got the feeling that in a vote that was this controversial and this critical, that it would have been a good idea basically for all the city council members to accept that invitation. It, you know, it's just a few hours of your time. It's the weekend, and that's what they were requesting. And I think that I understood why they did what they did, but I thought that aspect of it, where they wouldn't even ride around with the officers, was it didn't show them in a particularly good light. They're elected officials. They serve the people. Mm-hmm. They also serve the police. And it might have been a good time to watch and see what they were doing.
And also, why wasn't there a public or many public hearings on this? And if you want to do it, why not have a pilot project? I mean, this was almost rammed down, you know, the throats of people. There wasn't an opportunity to really have a give and take. Besides the ride with the police, what else was being done to show people this was necessary or not necessary? I think it hurts us. I think police, you know, when you see police who are retiring at an earlier age, when you see recruitment much less, I don't think it helps make the case that being a policeman in New York is a very rewarding profession.
Well, Rabbi, I think there's just an overall breakdown in respect for each other and an appreciation for differences of opinion. Just because you have the votes doesn't mean that you have to ram something down the throats of 9 million citizens in New York. And even though I said before, I have some sympathy for the city council members because some of them individually have some stories to tell that are pretty, you know, frightening about situations they had with the police. But now that you're in a position of authority, when you're in a position as an elected official where you can make change, I would think you would want to hear all the evidence before you vote. And the public hearings, really, that might have eased a situation such as this, and perhaps maybe it might have even changed a few people's minds. But I think that this is a prevalent sort of infection that is showing up too many times when someone has some kind of authority and they absolutely refuse to listen to another point of view.
This is Greg Kelly. To my friends in the construction business, if you've been injured on the job, make just one call to the Construction Accident Lawyers at the law offices of Darren T. Moore. With hundreds of five-star reviews, they fight for more justice for every client and have secured millions of dollars in compensation for New York construction workers. Call 888-444-ATTY. That's 888-444-2889 for a free consultation. More diligence, more persistence, and more justice. Prior results don't guarantee similar outcomes.
Yeah. You know, I spoke with some of the city council members who were sharing their feelings about it. And I will tell you, there was a great deal of sincerity in those that I spoke to because they thought that this would actually make a difference in cutting back on what they perceive as an unfair an unfair attack on persons of color, that the numbers are so high. And they feel that if the officers are being watched, micromanaged essentially, that somehow that's going to lower those statistics.
Let me ask you this question. If the reality is that in a number of neighborhoods where crime is higher, you have a greater minority population, does that factor into any of the decision making?
That's the question. That's what I asked earlier in the broadcast.
Right.
You know, because if the expectation is that in a higher crime neighborhood, there's going to be higher numbers.
Right.
And if you're not engaging in the same on the same level of policing, intensity of policing in other neighborhoods, because the idea is, well, crime is low there, I don't have to apply it that way, then obviously the numbers are going to be skewed.
But it's not the fault of police. You know, it just seems to me this was a missed opportunity that we can do a lot better without, you know, giving police all this bookkeeping to do when we need them out in the streets looking, you know, after communities. And I think a great improvement has been made in relations, and we kind of minimize that. Let's go on to another topic, the migrants. I mean, there's a whole, you know, latest story, migrants attacking police, right? No recommendation of bail, and they were released by the judge.
Well, you know, the governor just said something about this overall attitude between human beings, especially within our city. And it seems to me that a lot of that is pointing to figures of authority. There is this rebellion against authority, against order. You know, I think we're seeing it manifested. So when you see two police officers trying to apprehend someone, and then you have a gang of citizens, well, not even citizens, migrants in this case, human beings, and what are they doing? They're kicking and pommeling law enforcement officers. That is a picture that something's wrong within
us. Who have been protecting them when they arrived here as migrants.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You walk by the Roosevelt Hotel, you have police out there guarding them as well. And to see this attack and then no bail?
And a revolving door. And again, what does that say? I can get away with it.
Right.
Governor?
It would be fine with me if those migrants are tried, convicted, of the crimes that they committed against those police officers. And the interesting thing was they were actually fighting each other. Hmm. And the police officers were trying to break up the fight, and then both sides found something they could agree on, which was to beat up the police, which is a horrible way of resolving differences. But the one thing we do have to remember is the bail does not relate to the guilt or innocence of the accused. It relates to the availability of the accused at the time of the trial. The argument against bail does not have to do with who these people attacked. It has to do of whether or not they're going to show up. Now, the fact that they are migrants is a mitigating factor. In other words, because they're migrants and you don't even know where they live, mm-hmm. you might want to remand them.
Mm-hmm.
And on that question, I don't know why that that decision wasn't explored.
And why wouldn't a judge put them in jail? You attack police. If you and I did it, well, I know if I did it, I would end up in prison. Not you guys. I'm just saying, it is shocking to me that after such an attack, no consequence.
Well, there may be consequence, Rabbi, and that's what I'm saying is if they have to go to trial. They have been accused of very serious crimes. And since they really had no real status here other than being a migrant anyway, at the end of that trial, that's when I'll make the judgment if they're not deported.
So do we deport them?
Well it looks like there are even more of them who are involved in the violent crime. I would tend to think they would be convicted, even if they weren't migrants or regular citizens, to a pretty strong penalty. To me, that then opens the door for the federal agencies mm-hmm. to deport them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about some other things. Both of you can address this. It was a whole story I sent to you, Reverend. Black churches and Israel.
Is it black churches in Israel?
And Israel, not in Israel.
You know what he's talking about, Governor? There were a group of clergy that had some meetings at the White House, and there's a collection of clergy from across the country, and did an open letter to President Biden, essentially chiding him on the position that he's taken with Israel. They were pro-Palestinian, and of course, engaged in the rhetoric about slave and slave master and oppressor and mm-hmm. oppressed mm-hmm. and, that whole language. And I think what's happening is the length that this conflict has gone on is wearying people. Even those who in the beginning were supportive of Israel are now saying, okay, when is this going to stop? How many lives have to be lost? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, by the way, I'm not sure that even in the beginning they were supportive of Israel. I think what we found is following the attack on October 7th, there was a deafening silence by many. They didn't condemn it. They just didn't say anything. And then as time went on, now all of a sudden, the calls for the ceasefire and no denunciation of Hamas. That's what I find, so demoralizing here, is you would think it would be natural to condemn a terrorist organization, especially what happened October 7th. But there's no mention of that and said, well, let's call for a ceasefire.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're putting Hamas back into, a dominant position in Gaza. It was just surprising to me that it wasn't thought through. It was simplify, oppressor, oppressed. I don't think that is an equation that makes sense here, especially when people have the opportunity to live in peace all these years and just refuse to do so. Mm-hmm. Governor, what do you say?
It is hard for me to articulate the anger and frustration that I feel over the attack on Israel on October 7th. And that within an hour, I was listening to the radio coming from an event. Israel was warned by 50 countries in the United Nations. So the first thing they did was not inquire how many people got killed. Mm-hmm. How could we be of help? They had to write these memorandums that they sent to Israel about showing restraint mm-hmm. and not getting carried away because of this. That would be as if someone breaks into your house, is tearing up your furniture and beating up your family, and you have a gun, and they say, take it easy, you know, we come in peace. It's just outrageous. And I think that it opened up versions of anti-Semitism that I didn't actually believe existed anymore. In other words, I've thought over the past 30 years living here in New York City that people have gotten along a whole lot better, and you don't have these sort of battles and arguments about things. And now I feel like I'm pushed back into that era. This is outrageous. When they have these Palestinian rallies, they never stop for a moment saying, by the way, after everything that's happened to the Palestinians, let's just remember that 1,200 Jewish people living in Israel got killed today as well. They don't say a word.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, wonder, you know, sometimes when I just can't figure it out myself, I go to the, what would Martin Luther King do? And I think Martin Luther King would totally be standing with Israel and would stand up. And Reverend, I'm not talking about all the ministers in the black church, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a sense that we don't want this conflict to go on and on and on like it is in the Ukraine or what happened in Vietnam.
Right.
But there's got to be a point where some sense of caring and fairness is afforded to the victims and people who are related to the victims and people who care about the victims. Yeah.
You know what I found unfair about the article? There was no reference to the black churches, to the ministers who were speaking out for Israel.
Oh, of course not.
Right?
It wouldn't have been the point.
I mean, you and others, right.
They didn't call me.
They didn't call you. They didn't call a number of us. Let me be fair about this. You also have a so-called Jewish group. I think they did JVP, Jewish Voices for Peace, that took out a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for an immediate ceasefire, not denouncing Hamas. And one of my friends who's a loyal listener, he says, how outrageous. And many of them signed the name of Rabbi. You know, I find sometimes the insignificant organizations make themselves significant by yelling, by screaming. They're small in number, but by the noise they make, you think they're large in number. So this is an organization that gets funding. Nobody knows where the funding comes from. Took out a full-page ad. That's not inexpensive, full-page ad in the Times. You know, and they were making statements comparable to what was coming out of those churches. So, you know, we do have people who I don't understand where the moral compass is that you can't denounce Hamas clearly, unequivocally. I don't get that kind of thinking. But
maybe the most anachronistic thing about this entire situation is the number of people that you just referred to, Rabbi, who are sympathizers with Hamas, who attacked Israel, and Hezbollah trying to attack the United States and these other things that are going on, that if they were successful, and now we're living under their rule, these same people, Jewish people, mm-hmm. LGBT people, women activists, you know, regular activists, would all wind up getting punished, even though they actually supported, to some degree, the actions yeah. that these terrorist groups are taking.
You know, the Rev and I have had some discussions on this last week as well, that when you look at the protests, the signs, it doesn't just talk about Lanz has killed the Jews and Hitler was right. So it's a deep-seated anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic sentiment that runs through the veins of a number of these individuals, and many of them young people.
Yeah, beyond the state of Israel as a nation.
Right.
It's the Jew problem.
Right,
it's,
right.
And it's always been that way historically.
It never goes away.
Yeah.
It never goes. All right, so Governor, what do we have to look forward to after we discussed all the depressing things around us? What do we look forward to going forward?
Well, there's Black History Month coming up.
All right.
You know that. We're the third day of, fourth day of Black History Month. Mm-hmm. And one of the great, since we were on this subject, you know, some of the tremendous relationships that existed between black and Jewish people, mm-hmm. Particularly the Jews couldn't get jobs in the school systems in the South, and they got hired in the black schools in the historically black colleges and universities. And then, of course, the fact I always point out that 65% of the whites that went south during the Freedom Rides were Jewish. Mm-hmm. Two of them, Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, were killed down there.
Right.
And just the tremendous the liberation of the Jewish communities by the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II, there's so many great stories of relationship of these two groups that really received peril for centuries, working together to help each other. And I think that deep down, most of us, although I'm not sure how many anymore, really want to live in peace with each other and love the differences among each other and learn more about how all of us have lived and grown up in different cultures, which is the tapestry that we hope makes America really great. Mm-hmm. Not just saying America is great because we're only going to worry about ourselves and no one else, but great because we have traditionally worried about everyone, even beyond our borders.
Yeah, a testimony to our greatness. Not that we need to be made great again. Still great and always have been. This is the most incredible experiment in a democratic republic in the history of civilization, as far as I'm concerned. And look at what we've done. Look at what we've accomplished. People are trying to get into America. Mm. We don't have a border problem because people are trying to escape. But people are trying to come in.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was talking to Dvorah Halberstam, who is the founder of the Brooklyn Jewish Children's Museum, and she's telling me very proud of the number of African-American kids who work together with the school. The museum works with the schools to get kids to go into it. We need to make sure programs of that nature continue when we get our communities standing stronger with one another. Coming up.
But wait. Uh-oh. I'm not finished with him.
So, Governor, there is God.
You know, yeah. My wife and I were prepared to go away on a vacation to the Bahamas, and then all of a sudden we were told, don't go because of gang violence and tourists being murdered. That is now true in Barbados. It is now true in Jamaica. Is there a global hostility? Is there an anger and a violence emerging a la Genesis chapter 6? Huh? What's happening with humanity, Governor?
There just seems to be a heightened level and a lower tolerance of what rules are and what, you know, people go to these countries. This is their major way of raising money.
Mm-hmm. Source of income.
Yeah. It's mm-hmm. a source of income. And unfortunately, it's not, I've read about this increase in crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really frightening to go away thinking you're going to sit on the beach. And then you're sitting on the beach hoping nobody knows you're there.
Yeah.
See, Governor, the difference between Reverend Bernard, you and I, he was talking about going to Barbados and Jamaica. You and I talk about going to the beach. You know, that's going to Coney Island. That's our vacation. It's a great day. You know, it's a different world. All right, Governor David A. Patterson, as always, we enjoy having you. We look forward to your being with us because you bring a lot to the table. And we are privileged to have you with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I hope
I've
saved enough to talk to Mr. Katsimatidis in another hour.
Assuming he wants to talk to you after he listens to this.
We'll see what happens. Yeah. Governor, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you both. What a wonderful show.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for more of The Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC.